طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is John Roberts. How to begin a new year? Well, we're going to begin by asking the question, how did we get here? How did the Zionist project create what we have today in Palestine, Israel? And we turn to University of Massachusetts Boston Professor Leila Farsak to answer that question by laying out a concise history of the domination of historic Palestine by Israel, and end by taking a look at what Palestinians are doing to resist that domination. Leila Farsak's presentation, titled The History of Palestinian Resistance to Zionism, was recorded at a conference at UMass Boston on Palestinian solidarity. Here is Professor Leila Farsak.
The history of Palestinian resistance to Zionism. And it's very important to bear in mind that this is a very old struggle and a very old resistance. And the way I'd like to talk about it and to simplify it for you, I'm assuming you all saw the maps. So I don't need to show map and explain further about the maps. You are aware of the map. What I would like to say is that Palestinian resistance can be divided into four main periods. Ever since the problem of Zionism started in 18, I mean, the history of Zionism, if we want to date it to the Basel Conference and the creation of the World Zionist Organization in 1897, I would say that the Palestinian resistance since then went through four main periods. The first period is from 1897 until, I would say, the British Mandate. And the British Mandate is dated from 1922, which is when Britain took over control of Palestine and the Ottoman Empire dissolved. But it's important to remember that during the Ottoman Empire, when Palestine was under the Ottoman Empire, which was from 1458 until 1918, but when the Palestinians started to be confronted with the Zionist project in 1897, there was already Palestinian and Arab concern with the Zionist project. And they were actually active in showing and talking and reaching the higher political level to protest the Zionist project. The Palestinian encounter with the Zionist project was not so much an encounter with the Jews. It was an encounter with these foreign settlers that were coming to Palestine, that built their settlement in the area of the Galilee in particular, in the northern part of Palestine. And their concern was not the fact that these people came, but above all that they were European and they did not mingle with the local population. That they wanted to be on their own and they were buying land, and once they bought the land, they started excluding the Arabs. Okay? This exclusion of the Arab really happened in what's called the Second Aliyah, which is in the 1912, okay? So there was this little bit of concern among the peasants. But also the intellectuals, the Palestinian intellectuals, started to be concerned and were aware of the Zionist propaganda already in the 1902, 1910. And we know that in 1908, important Palestinian notables went as far as to Istanbul to talk with the Ottoman Empire, Ottoman governor, Sultan at the time, to protest the Zionist project, which they clearly see as a project of people who want to colonize the land rather than of people who wanted to settle in the land. People, you know, the Zionist propaganda often says that there was no Palestinian resistance, they were not opposed to the Palestinian, they, you know, or Arab propaganda sometimes says the Arab Palestinians were not aware of the Zionist project. Actually, we know of a fact today that Palestinian opposition to the Zionist project made itself vocal already at the beginning of the century. And it made itself vocal in two ways. One, by Palestinian peasant protesting their expulsion, but also by Palestinian intellectual and, you know, mayor of Jerusalem, going as far as to the government in Istanbul protesting the project. And it's also important to remember that the Ottoman Sultan, although he was approached by Herzl to give a home for the Jews in Palestine, he refused. And although he was the Sultan himself, so it's important to remember that also the Ottoman government was not supportive of the Zionist project. On the premise, again, that Jews are welcomed, but Zionist project is not welcomed. The turning point, of course, as you all know, is the Balfour Declaration. The Balfour Declaration was a promise given by Britain in 1917, so before the First World War was over, whereby the Zionist World Organization, under the direction of Wiseman, Chaim Wiseman, approached the British government and tried to lobby for a British support for the creation of a Jewish home in Palestine. And in 1917, they get an official endorsement from his king, the Majesty, the King of Britain, which in this famous declaration called the Balfour Declaration, because it was the foreign minister at the time who received this letter from the representative of the Zionist organization, in which Britain and Her Majesty, His Majesty, the King at the time, say clearly that they look in favor and support the idea of the creation of a Jewish home in Palestine. They didn't say a Jewish state. They didn't say whole of Palestine. They said they support the creation of a Jewish home in Palestine. It be understood that the civil and religious rights of the people living on the land will not be violated. It was a very important success for the World Zionist Organization, exactly 20 years after its creation, because they got the superpower of the time endorsing their national project. Britain at the time did not, and in that declaration, does not talk about Palestinians or the Arab as having political rights. It talks about them only as having religious and civil rights. This is why it was such a problematic declaration from an Arab perspective and a Palestinian perspective, because it took away and did not acknowledge the indigenous people's right to self-determination. It acknowledged the Jewish people's right to self-determination as the World Zionist Organization defined it. Because the Balfour Declaration also was so intelligent, because it said, yeah, the Jews can create a home in Palestine, but it be understood that the inhabitants' civil and religious right will not be violated, but also the Jewish right in Europe and in the West will not be violated. Which basically means if a Jew wants to remain in Britain and be British, that will be protected. The creation of a Jewish home in Palestine does not take away from the Jews outside Palestine their political rights. So it was an incredible, it's like the U.S. today endorsing a Bosnian state. It's like the U.S. today endorsing East Timor. You know, everybody's against it, but the superpower at the time is for it. And as soon as the Arab heard of it and the Palestinian heard of it, they were very upset and expressed their anger at this declaration in two ways. One, by massive demonstration in Palestine in 1920, one when the British were already there and declared the mandate, but also Palestinian politician and Arab politician went to London and discussed with the Britain about how unfair this declaration is, and they got insurances at the time that don't worry, what we mean by a home is not a state, and what we clearly mean in it is not in the whole of Palestine, in some part. So it was left vague. And this is very typical of all international declaration, because it's just a tool. The core issue is how, with this very important stock share, you're going to cash it in with something concrete or not. And the World Zionist Organization was very successful in taking this very important declaration and make sure that they can cash it in with the creation of a state. How did they do that? Or what? I mean, I suppose you heard before how it happened, but the second phase we're entering now, which is the phase of the British mandate, where Britain comes to Palestine, take over Palestine. Britain and France divided the old Ottoman Empire into states, and they created the present boundary of Palestine, which is more or less the historical one. And the mandate clearly said that the role of Britain is not to just colonize Palestine. No. The role of Britain in Palestine as well as in Jordan as in Iraq, where the mandate applied, was to prepare the indigenous inhabitants for independence. The argument being that they're still not ready for independence because they don't have modern institution, modern state. But it's important to remember that. And we're going to train them until they become independent. But in that respect, in Palestine, the British had already started off on the wrong foot, because while promising that, they also promised the Zionist movement a home in Palestine. When the riots started in 1920-21, the foreign secretary at the time clearly said that what we mean by Jewish home is something still to be determined. It doesn't mean a state in Palestine, and it doesn't mean all of Palestine. Okay? And that respect was very important, because he stops the Zionist plan of saying that the boundaries of the Balfour Declaration went as far as Jordan. The other thing which is important is how you're going to now create a new government. Britain started off by talking about a one-state solution. He said, we're going to have one single government for whole of Palestine. And in this, there will be equal representation between Jews, Muslim, and Arabs, actually. The category was not Jews, Muslim, and Christian, between Jews and Arabs. And the governor at the time tried very much to sell this idea to the Palestinians, but they refused. They refused because they could not understand why 10% of the population, actually 7% of the population at the time, should have equal representation in government. Okay? And why should Hebrew, English, and Arabic become three the official language when the official language of the land was Arabic? And also because they saw already from the very beginning is that the British favored much more the Western Jews than they did favor the Palestinian. So they had higher salaries in the administration, because what Britain did, the administration, the state, all had Arabs and non-Arabs in it. But it would give the Jew a higher salary than the local, on the argument that they are more educated and more sophisticated. I mean, it's a form of colonialism, of course, as you know. But the important is just to remember that in terms of administration, Britain tried to make a single administration and tried to do a single state. And the position of the Palestinian was, we want to be all Palestinian. We don't want to be categorized into Christian, Muslim, and Jew. The Zionists, of course, were not interested in that, because the Zionists from early on wanted a separate state. They did not want to share the land with the people. They wanted the land just for themselves. And what Britain does during this time, favor the World Zionist Organization, allow Jewish immigration, allow the underground Zionist organization, turn a blind eye on whether the World Zionist Organization was bringing in arms or not, while forbidding the Arabs from having any arms. And what we start early on having, we're starting to have, again, Palestinian opposition at the elite level, but important grassroots peasants and workers' opposition to the Zionist project. And we see that in two major events. One is the riots of 1921, and then there's a major riot in 1929, in which the last Jewish community of Hebron actually left or was expelled. And was important, that event, because it marked the final attempt by Britain to deal with Palestine as a single entity, and started dealing with the Arabs on one side and the Zionists on the other. Okay? And that riot was important because it was massive demonstration in Hebron, in Jerusalem, in Safad, in Jaffa, in a number of places where the Palestinians said, we are against Jewish Zionist immigration. Again, the problem was not the Jews as Jews. The problem was there are these colonizers coming, expelling the indigenous people from the land, taking their land, although it was through sale, because it was absentee law that sold the land to the Jewish World Zionist Organization. But the ones who were getting displaced were the peasants who always worked on that land. Because the World Zionist Organization and the Jewish agency, or the Jewish government in Palestine at the time, took a decision, because of the strong labor union they had, not to rely on Arab labor. So the Palestinians not only saw their land being taken away from them, but also their jobs taken away from them. And Britain sends a number of commissioners to come and study the situation and say what to do about it. And they reported in a number of reports that the problem was a problem of land, and problem of poverty, a problem of unequal development, and bias, British bias towards the World Zionist project, which is, in their view, was wrong. So we do have a number of reports coming up by the British saying this is an Arab state, more or less. Jewish immigration should be minimized or, you know, anyway, slowed down. And the land issue has to be addressed. The Zionists do not like it at all. They mobilize the government against it. And then the major event that happens again, we have another major revolt that actually takes place by the Palestinians in 1936. It's a very important revolt because it was really the first, not just a riot, it was the first really intifada that happens in the Palestinian community, 1936. It was initiated and led by a guy called Izzeddin al-Qassam. So when you're hearing of the Qassam rockets, when you hear of the Qassam brigades, they are in memory of this person who was actually originally Syrian and who lived in Palestine and was very, very worried about increasing Jewish immigration into Palestine and their appropriation of Palestinian land and of Palestinian property. And he started the revolt, and the revolt lasted for 3 years, in which the Palestinians declared strikes in major cities, in which you had massive demonstration. It was really a grassroots organization, and the elite, the Palestinian elite at the time, joined in the bandwagon, I mean, adopted it afterwards and tried to force British hand into giving some concession, which included stopping the immigration and considering Palestinian political rights. But what happens during this, so it goes from 1936 until 1939. But also Britain at the time comes along with a guy called Mr. Peel, Sir Peel, and proposes a solution to the conflict, which is called the Peel Commission proposal. And it was the first partition plan. British policy until 1937 was a solution to Palestine was a single state in which Jews and Arabs ruled together. Palestinian position was, we don't want to be treated as Jews, Christian, and Muslim. We want to be treated as Palestinians. Okay? What Britain then does is say, okay, what we're going to propose is partition. The British, both parties rejected it, but the Second World War erupts, and it manages to calm the Arabs by giving them promises that at the end of the war, there will be one single Palestinian state, okay, and there will be restriction on Jewish immigration. As you know, after the war ends, this is not what happens. The problem escalates further as there's more and more Jewish immigration, and as by now we have one-third of the population being Zionist Jews, two-thirds of the population are Palestinian.
See the burning wreckage of the British tanker Empire Cross. 23 of the tanker's crew are missing after her cargo of high-octane petrol exploded by the fanatics of the Irgun and Stern terrorist gangs.
A heavy explosion had rocked the all-Arab city as the headquarters of the Arab National Committee was blown sky-high. Official statements put the casualty list at more than 100.
We have Britain deciding to hand in the file of Palestine to the United Nations. And what happens is that the UN then comes up with a solution to the conflict, which is the famous partition plan. Right? Partition plan that promises that the only, and it's important to remember this partition plan because it's a UN resolution. So in other words, it's the opinion of the whole international community that the only solution to the Arab-Israeli conflict is in the creation of two states, one for the Jews, one for the Arabs. The problem with the partition plan was that it was very unfair on the Palestinians in three ways. One, it gave the Palestinian only 46% of the land, although they were two-thirds of the population. It did not make Jerusalem a corpus separatum, which means it's an international city, okay? And it would have meant de facto the creation of a refugee problem, which the UN was aware of and was against. So the UN did say in the partition plan that the partition means that whoever lives in the area which is Jewish has to remain there if he wants to remain there. They opposed it, but the leadership was not very well organized. As you know, the war is declared, Israel is created, and Israel is created in 1948 on 78% of Palestine, not on 56% which was offered to it by the United Nations. Now we enter into the third phase of Palestinian resistance, which is between 1948 until 1967. And that's a period in which Palestinian resistance was part of an Arab resistance against colonization. The Palestinians did not have their own separate leadership. They had various factions. But above all, the ideology of the time in the 1950s and 60s was the liberation of Palestine passes through Arab unity. This idea, of course, was smashed in 1967 with Israel's second war or third war on the Arabs and the Palestinians, because in 1967, Israel smashes the idea of Arab unity. It invades Egypt, Jordan, and Syria and takes land from each of them, as well as incorporates the West Bank and Gaza within its territory. It does not annex them, it controls them. But the importance of that war is that in 6 days, Israel is able to gain land 6 times its size before the war, and to have a problem now with Egypt, not only just with the Palestinians, it has it now with Egypt and with Syria and with Jordan. And then the UN produces this famous UN resolution 242, very important. We have two important resolutions. One is 181, which is the partition plan, the famous partition plan. You have to remember them. You have another one called 194, which was in December 1948, which is the resolution talking about the right of return for the refugees. It affirms the right of Palestinians to go back to their land, to compensation and to resistance. And then you have UN Resolution 242, which is a UN Security Council resolution that says that the only solution to the Arab-Israeli conflict, again, is land for peace. Israel gives back land and in exchange receives from the Arab countries recognition and peace. Now, UN Resolution 242 is very important because actually it's very, very unfair to the Palestinians. There is no mention of the Palestinians in UN Resolution 242. It talks of the Palestinian just as a refugee problem that needs a solution. Okay? But the importance of the 1967 war was that it gave rise to the whole massive guerrilla movement, Palestinian guerrilla movement. Palestinian resistance had a major strength in being a resistance, an armed resistance against Israel. Okay? So before 67, it was resistance to the Arab armies. After 67, the Palestinians say, forget it. The only way how the Palestinians can liberate themselves is by themselves taking the arms and themselves representing themselves. And this is the time when the PLO, which was created already by the Arabs in 1964, so the Arab create the PLO. The PLO stands for the Palestine Liberation Organization. In other words, the representative body of the Palestinians, like the World Zionist Organization representing the Jews. In 1968, Arafat and the whole mass, popular, guerrilla-type movement of Fatah, Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine, Democratic Front for Liberation of Palestine, take over the PLO, okay? And they elect Arafat as the president. And Arafat becomes, and the PLO become the representative of the Palestinian people. And Palestinian struggle becomes then, policy becomes, we want to prove to the world that we are a people, in other words, have a right to self-determination. What does self-determination mean? Mean we have a right to rule ourselves, we have a right to govern ourselves, and this is a right, and we have a right to go back to our land, which was taken away from us. And Arafat and the Palestinians managed between 1968 and 1974 to put the PLO on the international map, because in 1974 the PLO is invited to the UN, and Arafat speaks at the UN. Well, the PLO is given an observer status at the UN, because basically it was an international recognition that the PLO is the sole and legitimate representative of the Palestinian people, and that the Palestinians have a right to their home. Now, what happens now with the resistance is the Palestinian resistance is an armed resistance against a very strong army, which is Israel. And we go through between 1974 until 1987. A struggle by which the Palestinians are resisting from Jordan, but above all from Lebanon, and Israel is attacking them, because Israel's aim becomes after 74 to eliminate the PLO. And in 1982, the war against Lebanon, that's what the war was about, to try and eliminate Palestinian resistance, eliminate anything called Palestinian, and anything called Palestinian armed resistance or just political resistance. And although it manages to kick out the Palestinians out of Lebanon, in 1982, the Arab world as well as the international community is in solidarity of the Palestinian struggle. But what was the struggle about? What was being offered? What was being offered by the international community is basically a two-state solution, whereas the PLO was talking at the time about what it wants is a secular democratic state in which Jews, Muslims, and Christians live together. Okay? The fourth phase in Palestinian resistance happens in 1987, which is the first intifada, and that's when the Palestinian resistance shifts from being outside of Palestine, how it was in the 70s and 80s, it was in Jordan, it was in Lebanon, and becomes inside the West Bank and Gaza. The first intifada, which you all know or you heard of, which happens in 1987, is Palestinian youth starting to throw stones at Israeli soldiers and declare that they do not want to be ruled by an Israeli army, by an occupying army, because Israel in the West Bank and Gaza is an occupier. This grassroots civil disobedience, unarmed resistance in 1987 gives the PLO an important further legitimation. And in 1988, the PLO makes its historical compromise with Israel, which is when Arafat declares he accepts UN Resolution 242 and accepts Israel's existence and say that we want to create and makes the Declaration of Independence. The PLO declares the Declaration of Independence, meaning by it that we recognize Israel. We recognize 242, which means you recognize Israel on 78% of the land. Okay? And in exchange, we want to have our own state, independent state, in the West Bank and Gaza. Of course, Israel is not happy. We go backwards and forwards. But the important point is, by 1993, the Americans and the international community say, we've had it. It's enough. We have to solve this problem once and for all. And they call for an international conference in 1991 called the Madrid Conference. But what you need to remember is 1993, the famous handshake between Arafat, representative of the PLO, and Israel in Washington, in which it was important. I mean, it was, I know we're very angry at Oslo, but Oslo had something very important because it was the first time ever since the inception of the conflict, since the 1897 and the Zionist, World Zionist Organization. In 1993, it was the first time that the Israeli officially and unofficially accepted the existence of the Palestinian people. Because before 1993, for Israel, all these people living in the West Bank and Gaza, these refugees in Lebanon, Jordan, these are Arabs. Golda Meir used to say there's no such thing as the Palestinian people. They don't exist. Israeli politicians, even Netanyahu, until 1993 used to say, these are not Palestinians, there's no such thing as Palestinians, these are Arabs. Their problem is to be solved with Jordan, through negotiation between Israel and Jordan. Their problem is to be solved by Lebanese government integrating them and stop making them refugees. But in 1993, Israel, the state of Israel, officially acknowledged that there is such a thing as the Palestinian people, that they have a right to self-determination, and that they have to share the land with them. That's the famous speech of Rabin at the time. The problem, though, with Oslo, that's the only good thing about Oslo, okay? And also the very intelligent thing about Oslo, because in exchange for recognizing the Palestinian, what Israel said, I'm going to now control you according to my terms. You want a state? Fine. But according to my term, I'm going to give you a state, which is not a state, which is a Bantustan. It's unviable economically, unviable territorially. All what you really have as Palestinian, you're going to have elections. You're going to have ministries. You're going to decide your educational policy. You're going to decide your health policy. You're going to decide even your economic policy. But you cannot exit and enter without permit from Israel. I'm giving you an autonomy, but I'm going to make it appear like a state. And this here we shift then into the Oslo years, whereby the Palestinians have struggled. If you see, they resisted, you know, peacefully. They resisted diplomatically. They resisted through arms. They resist again grassrootly and mass-based. They accept the international verdict. So they did the whole way. They are on the map. Israel recognized them. But by 1993, the hope was, okay, we will have the state. But by 2000, we don't have a state. What we really have is further fragmentation. Now, and the culmination of the Palestinian struggle, if one can say, we have then the fifth phase of the resistance, which is the resistance that starts happening in the 1990s and really escalates in 2000, which is resistance through suicide bombing. Suicide bombing did not exist in 1980. Did not exist in 1970. You had freedom fighters. And it's very important to make a distinction between a freedom fighter and a suicide bomber. Both are sacrificing their life for the cause. Both are struggling against oppression. Both are resisting against occupation. But The freedom fighter does not go in a war or does not fight an Israeli knowing that he's going to be killed. He doesn't use his body as the instrument of resistance. The suicide bomber uses his body as the instrument of resistance because that's the only thing left for him to resist with. It's very important to remember that. And this really happens in the 1990s and escalates after 2000. And also what we really also start seeing after 1990 is that the Palestinian resistance shifts from a secular debate, in other words, you're resisting because you have a right to a state, towards a struggle which is coded in an Islamic, in religious terms, but it is fundamentally still nationalistic. And what do I mean by that? They mean that the Islamists, they're not fighting to create an Islamic state. Hamas is not fighting to create an Islamic state. Hamas is fighting to expel Israeli occupation, to have independence. But what the difference is that Hamas is saying resisting the occupation is just not a moral right, it's not just a human right, it's not just because of my land, but also because God tells me I have to oppose oppression. They use a religious language, but their struggle is fundamentally nationalistic. I want you to remember that, because in the US there's an attempt to demonize Hamas. Hamas is not much different from Fatah. They fight over who's going to become ruler. But in terms of their aim to end Israeli occupation, to have their independence and to go home, allow the refugees to return home, they are the same. But it's important that this struggle gets coded in the Islamic religious language. And I say it's a resistance that in a way failed. In what sense it failed? I think Palestinian resistance today is at a major turning point, because we Palestinians tried everything. And some argue that we were defeated. Okay. Because what happened in Gaza, last war on Gaza, and what has happened with also exemplifies a major defeat or major oppression of Israel, but an Israel that managed to smash Palestinian military resistance. And also to get the Palestinians, especially in Gaza, to divide them, okay, and to get the Gaza into a state of desperation. This doesn't mean that Palestinian resistance will end. And this doesn't mean that it will ever end, because Palestinians will continue to resist. But what's happening is that the pattern of Palestinian resistance is becoming more difficult. And this is why the Palestinians are shifting increasingly now towards two strategies. One is peaceful resistance, of which the call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions is very important. And secondly, they're opting for more international grassroots support worldwide, in the US and elsewhere, to support this struggle, which is also very important. Especially at a time, which I need to say, that the international community, not only did it say that the solution is a two-state solution, with Bush's famous speech in 2002 and the roadmap, we have a new development in the international community, which is after 2003, the US and the quartet, the international community said the solution to the conflict is not just two states. The solution to the conflict is the creation of a Palestinian state. So the Palestinian state becomes not only a right, it also becomes a necessity to solving the conflict. The problem, though, is that on the ground, you're not getting a state. You're getting a Bantustans. And Israel is not even interested in that. But it's important to remember that, because I think what's happening today, in my view, is that this 60-year struggle to try to solve the conflict through two-state solution has actually failed. The Palestinians are for the moment defeated, but they are going to rebound, and they are rebounding. And the way they are rebounding is by emphasizing civil disobedience, by emphasizing international solidarity, and by calling the international community to hold Israel accountable to international law. Okay, and they're also having a big debate on whether they should shift to a one-state solution or a two-state solution, but so far they're not into that debate. Their major point now is how to mobilize international support, and in this respect, especially the U.S., because I think the U.S. is key, is the only solution to the conflict, because they are the one that have the power to force Israel to just adhere to international law. We're not even talking about vanishing. We're talking about Israel adhering to international law. And I think all of you have an important role to play, not only in informing, but also in mobilizing, in campaigning, in writing to your congressman, in writing to your president. It's really that stage whereby international solidarity, grassroots solidarity, is very important, also in terms of being intelligently directed to put an impact governors and policymakers. I'll stop at this. I know I've been a little bit long, but I wanted you to have the whole view. Okay, but I'll take questions. I'll stay 10 more minutes and I'll take your questions.
That was Professor Leila Farsek speaking at a conference on Palestinian solidarity at UMass Boston. The second question we're asking this morning to begin the new year is, what is happening to the vision of Arab solidarity in support of Palestine's quest for freedom from Israeli occupation and domination? Columbia professor Joseph Massad recently published an article on the Electronic Intifada website, which speaks to that question. The article is entitled, Delinking the Palestinians, and I would like to share excerpts from this very disturbing analysis. Massad writes, and I quote from the article, since the more recent third Palestinian uprising started in early October, there has been a rush by different Arab countries and intellectuals to legitimize their good relations with and their love for Israel. With the Palestinian uprising refusing to abate in November, panic set in, and among the Arab anti-Palestinian camp, which has gained considerable ground across the Arab world since the 1978 Egypt-Israel Camp David Accords, precipitating a rush by Arab governments and their pundits to delink Arabs and Muslims from the Palestinians. On November 1st, the Egyptian government, in addition to being one of the two jailers of 1.8 million Palestinians in Gaza, voted openly and for the first time ever in favor of Israel at the United Nations when it supported the latter's bid for membership on the UN Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space. A few weeks later, on November 24th, the Kuwaiti pundit Saleh al-Sayeji published an op-ed declaring that Israel is not our enemy. On November 27th, the United Arab Emirates government approved an Israeli diplomatic mission in Abu Dhabi. Meanwhile, Saudi officials manifested their love for Israel by continuing their open and secret meetings with its officials, who reciprocated with public declarations about Israel's warm relations with its Sunni Arab allies. Whereas the Palestinian national struggle against the Jewish settler colony has been thoroughly delegitimized in the eyes of many Arabs by the Palestine Liberation Organization's surrender of the rights of the Palestinian people when it signed the 1993 Oslo Accords, the question of Jerusalem has remained a sticking point for Arab countries seeking to normalize with Israel. Here, Jerusalem is not seen as a large Palestinian city whose lands and holy places are being confiscated day by day for exclusive Jewish colonial use, and whose Palestinian population, Muslims and Christians alike, is expelled, besieged, humiliated, and denationalized. Rather, Jerusalem is depicted as merely a religious symbol for Christians and Muslims whose sanctuaries have fallen under the rule of Israel and Jewish colonial settlers. Jewish settler colonialism in this Palestinian city has not abated since the 1880s with the expulsion and ethnic cleansing of the first wave of Jerusalemites and the occupation and ethnic cleansing of the western parts of their city, concluded in 1948. The remaining and oldest parts of Jerusalem, where its holy places are located, would not become subject to Jewish colonial supremacy until Israel occupied them in 1967. The Hashemites of Jordan appointed themselves the custodians of the Muslim holy places of Jerusalem as part of their public treaty normalizing relations with Israel in 1994. Their mission has been less than successful in the last two decades. Indeed, it has not stopped the encroachment of Israeli government-backed groups intent on destroying the Al-Aqsa Mosque and replacing it with a Jewish temple. But while the Hashemites would never compromise on the sanctity of Jerusalem, the Jordanian government successfully lobbied the Vatican beginning in the late 1990s to change the designation of the site of the baptism of Jesus from the west bank of the River Jordan on the Palestinian side, where it had been traditionally, to the east bank of the river on the Jordanian side. The Vatican would add its stamp of approval during the 2009 visit of Pope Benedict XVI to the country. It has since become an attraction for European and American Christian tourists, to the glee of Jordanian officials. More recently, the Jordanians successfully lobbied the UN cultural body UNESCO to support their contested claims. While the Jordanian project may be informed by plans to promote tourism and compete with Palestine as the birthplace of Christianity, their actions intentionally or unintentionally serve the very same overall strategy of desanctifying Palestine's holy places. But if the site of Christ's baptism can be changed so easily, why not change the very character of the Muslim holy places in Jerusalem as well? To this latter task, the half-British Iraqi Orientalist Kanan Makia, who lobbied the U.S. government to invade and bomb Iraq in 1990-91 and again in 2003, and predicted that Iraqis would welcome their American invaders with sweets and flowers, would step up to make the case. The book, titled The Rock, argued that the Dome of the Rock was in fact not a monument conceived and built by Arab Muslims, but rather by a Jewish convert to Islam, Ka'b al-Akbar, who conceived it and pressed for its construction. The not-so-subtle objective of the anti-Palestinian Makiyah was to rob Palestinians and Muslims of their patrimony over the Muslim religious sites of Jerusalem and strengthen Zionist colonial claims to the land and holy places of Palestine. His charlatanism would remain a relatively lonely effort among Arab intellectuals until recently. It would be a third-rate Egyptian novelist and chauvinist, one Yosef Zidane, who would provide the new arguments. The pro-Mubarak Zidane, who in November 2009 joined the campaign launched by the sons of Hosni Mubarak against Algeria when its national football team beat Egypt at a World Cup qualifying match in Sudan, assailed the Algerians as living in a country that is a desert that extends everywhere, including to the souls of its people. As the Palestinians were delinked from Egyptian concerns through a renewed campaign of hate that the pro-Mubarak and pro-Sisi Egyptian media have not stopped spreading in the last 4 years, Zidane was recently resurrected by the Sisi media to join the campaign against the Palestinian people by helping to delink Muslims in general, and not only Egyptian Muslims, from Jerusalem. Zidane alleged in a recent discussion with journalists, with the flimsy evidence of a propaganda upstart, that the place to which the Prophet Muhammad ascended as per the Quranic story was not Jerusalem, but, contrary to the beliefs of Muslims in the last 14 centuries, was in the Arabian Peninsula near Taif in the Hejaz. In the tradition of Zionist propagandists who insist that since the Quran does not mention Jerusalem by name, the city is not holy to Muslims or to Islam, Zidane hoped to desanctify the city in line with the ongoing anti-Palestinian policies of the regime and media of Egyptian ruler Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. Israeli propagandists are often reminded that Mecca was mentioned but once in the Quran. Should Mecca, too, be considered unimportant for Muslims? The attempts to desanctify Jerusalem for Muslims, however, have been supplemented by rehabilitating the city for Egyptian Christians. As Israel has continued to murder Palestinian men, women, and children with increased intensity since the start of October, the new Egyptian Pope Tawadros II, who came of age during the Sadat era, embarked on a trip to Jerusalem, contravening the Coptic Church's standing policy banning under the penalty of excommunication any Egyptian Christian from visiting the occupied city until its liberation from Israeli settler colonialism. Whereas Arab Christians who went on pilgrimage to the city stopped being able to do so after its fall to Israeli settler colonialism, Egyptian Christians could in principle have resumed their pilgrimages after the Camp David Accords, were it not for Coptic Pope Cyril VI, who issued the decree banning Christian pilgrimage to the city following its fall in 1967. Pope Shenouda, who assumed the papacy in 1971, had the Holy Synod of the Coptic Orthodox Church of Alexandria and the See of St. Mark reiterate the decree in 1980. Pope Shenouda famously declared, quote, "From the Arab national perspective, we should not abandon our Palestinian brothers and our Arab brothers by normalizing our relations with the Jews. From the church's perspective, Copts who go to Jerusalem betray their church in the case of Al-Sultan Monastery that Israel refuses to return to the Copts." Unquote. Pope Shenouda's defiance of the deal at Camp David and his refusal to accompany Egyptian President Anwar Sadat on his 1977 visit to occupied Jerusalem, not to mention his protest against the sectarian current that grew in the shadow of Sadat's rule and which led to massacres of Egyptian Christians, would lead Sadat to exile him to a desert monastery in Wadi al-Natrun. Shenouda's Sadatist and Sisi-esque successor, Tawadros II, by contrast, understood the benefits he could obtain by undoing the defiance and cooperating with Sadat's and Mubarak's heir on the Egyptian throne. In doing so, Tawadros II seems oblivious to the dangers he has brought to the entire Egyptian Christian community, which is being tarred by Salafist and non-Salafist Muslim sectarian chauvinists as a sellout community to Israel on account of the Pope's actions. Like most Egyptian Muslims, most Egyptian Christians are poor and rural and have no stakes in this game, which is spearheaded by the Christian business class and the Coptic Pope, yet they will be the ones to fall victim to sectarian violence as a result. In this context, contrast the silence of Tawadros on Palestinian suffering with Shenouda's declaration in 2001 that he would not visit Jerusalem except with a Palestinian visa, and accompanied by the head of Al-Azhar, the renowned 1,000-year-old Center of Islamic Learning in Cairo, and my Arab brethren, which would only take place after the end of the occupation of Jerusalem. It is curious that as of April 2014, Tawadros upheld Shenouda's ban on pilgrimages to Jerusalem, but saw fit to visit the city during the ongoing Israeli carnage of the Palestinians. It is worth recalling here that Palestinian Authority leader Mahmoud Abbas and his former Prime Minister Salam Fayyad have in recent years encouraged Arab Muslims and Christians, especially leaders of Muslim-majority countries, to visit Jerusalem as part of the PA's ongoing collaboration with Israeli strategy. Indeed, despite the refusal of most Muslims and their leadership to heed the PA call, Egypt's Grand Mufti Al-Ghoma took the PA up on its invitation and visited the Al-Aqsa mosques in 2012. To further the delinking between Palestinians and Muslims, Israeli military contractors and American Islamophobes have been aggressively organizing and funding junkets to occupy Jerusalem for American Muslim leaders. These self-appointed leaders continue to go on these visits in defiance of Palestinian boycotts and then return home expressing their newfound admiration for Zionism. There seem to be several complementary strategies aiming to remove the last obstacle standing in the way of normalizing with Israel, including removing the taboo for Muslims and Christians to visit Jerusalem while under occupation, or in case this strategy fails, and its failure has indeed become a fact, to remove the sanctity of Jerusalem and that of other holy places in Palestine altogether, transferring what can be transferred of them to neighboring countries. The fear harbored by anti-Palestinian Arabs about a third Palestinian uprising could renew the Palestinian anti-colonial struggle and in the process inspire those in the Arab world whose uprisings were suppressed by Saudi-sponsored counter-revolutions to rise up again. Is the motivation behind the rush to normalize with Israel and do away with the question of the Jewish colonization of Jerusalem as a matter that should be of concern for Muslims and Christians in the Arab and Muslim worlds. Since Saudi Arabia has declared Iran and Shiites as the main enemy of all Sunni Muslims, any reminder that Israel has always been their enemy is unwelcome to the Saudi authorities and their Arab and especially Egyptian allies. In the post-coup Egyptian drowning in the sea of nationalist chauvinism against all its neighbors, Sudan, Palestinians in Gaza, Syria, Ethiopia, and Libya, except for Israel, the anti-Palestinian campaign is strongest, but is also being echoed across Gulf countries whose insistence that Iran and not Israel is the enemy of the oil sheikdoms and would get a further push if the question of Palestine were dissolved once and for all. That was excerpts from an article by Columbia professor Joseph Massad entitled "Delinking the Palestinians." And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org or access our archive of past broadcasts at truthandjusticeradio.org. All one word. truthandjusticeradio.org. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday when we will feature an interesting conversation between author and journalist Max Blumenthal and the progressive radio host Tom Harmon. You will not want to miss this. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.